Let me ask you something. Have you ever been ripped off? I would say probably most of us could say in one manner or another, or some degree or another, yeah, we probably have. I remember when I was a young fellow over in Korea, delightful spot called Camp Kaiser, South Korea, 4 miles south of DMZ. I remember I was in one of the bars one night. It's hard to believe, but I was. And this young lady wanted to borrow my cigarette lighter. So, sure, I figured she just wanted to light up her cigarette. So I handed her my cigarette lighter. She took off and never did see her or the cigarette lighter ever again. Now, that's probably a pretty minor thing. Maybe, I don't know if it was worth even a buck. But sometimes people get conned. I remember when I was a teenager living out on the farm, I remember there's a couple guys came around one time. And they said, well, we noticed you don't have any lightning rods on your barn. Well, which is true, which we didn't. And he said, well, we'll give you a really good deal. We can put those lightning rods on your barn for, I don't know what it was a very cheap price. And well, my dad declined. But the neighbor about a mile up the road must have thought it was a pretty good deal, because he did. He had these guys get up on top of his barn and put two or three lightning rods up there, whatever it was. But the only problem is, got to looking at it later, and the cable that ran down from the lightning rod to ground was rope. It wasn't even metal. It was just kind of painted silver, so it looked like metal. And this same neighbor, always looking for a bargain, had another group come along with a big truck, and they offered to paint his barn. Well, they came down and offered to paint our barn, but our barn was kind of new and it didn't need any paint. But their barn, he decided, well, it wouldn't be such a terrible bad idea to paint that barn. So they got this big truck, and they got this big sprayer out, and they sprayed it. They had, it was like 4 feet of overlay on the roof, and it just everywhere. It was like the windows were totally covered up, and it looked absolutely horrible. It was like a silver color. But the worst part of it is the first rain we got, most of it washed off. And it stayed like that for a long time. I mean, I always remember driving by and looking at that barn with all these big silver streaks on it, and I'm always thinking, man, that's about as ugly as anything I ever saw in my life. But you see, those guys, those neighbors of mine, they got conned. They got conned. And I want to talk about that this morning, but I'm going to talk about Satan, because Satan is the master con man. In fact, that's the title of my message, is Satan, the master con man. I don't know if any of you have ever heard the name Victor Lustig, but he was pretty well known because 100 years ago, maybe not quite, he sold the Eiffel Tower. He was born in Bohemia. And he traveled a lot between New York and Paris. And that wasn't his first major con, though. His first major con was he sold people a machine that supposedly printed $100 bills. And what he did was he had this contraption, and he actually had two $100 bills in it. And he plugged this thing in, turned it on, and it took 6 hours, he said, it took 6 hours for this machine to make a $100 bill. And so they'd wait around, and 6 hours later, this thing would spit out a genuine $100 bill. And he'd say, well, every 6 hours, it'll give you a $100 bill. And he actually sold this thing back in those days for like $25,000 or $30,000. And people bought this thing. And 6 hours later, sure enough, this thing gave him another $100 bill. But the problem is, any other paper that came out of that thing after that was blank paper. And by the time people figured out, boy, I got ripped on that one while money was gone, and so was Victor. In 1925... France was in the process of recovering from World War I, and the Eiffel Tower was standing, but you see, the Eiffel Tower was expensive to maintain. And so it cost the city of Paris a lot of money to maintain the Eiffel Tower. And this Victor Lustig, this really, really smooth con guy, read about that and learned about that in a newspaper or someplace. And he came up with an idea that was, well, I guess it was quite a brilliant idea, because he was an expert forger, you know. And he made some government documents and government credentials. And then he invited six scrap iron dealers to a special meeting in one of the hotels in Paris. And during this meeting, he informed them, you know, he told them, he gave them the sales pitch, that the Eiffel Tower was expensive, the city couldn't afford to have it, and they were going to sell it to some scrap, you know, people to just come in there and buy it and then scrap it out. And one of the guys that was in there and listened to this thought it was, you know, fell for it, hook, line, and sinker, and thought it was a great deal. And, of course, Ludwig told them, hush, hush, quiet. You know, we don't want this news to get out. The people of Paris would get real upset if they knew that we were going to go in there and tear down the Eiffel Tower and just haul it off for scrap. So we have to keep it quiet. We don't want the population to know about it. So we had him keep it really, really quiet. But he took the dealers, put them in a nice big limousine, drove it out to the Eiffel Tower, showed her everything about it, and convinced, well, at least one of the guys thought it was a very legitimate proposal, and gave Lustig a lot of money for the Eiffel Tower. And when he realized sometime later that he'd been ripped off big time, he was too embarrassed to tell the police about it. Just thought, how can I be so dumb as to fall for something like this? And so he didn't tell the police about it. So this Lustig, he took off with the money scot-free, and this guy, this scrap iron dealer guy, was out his money, and that was it. Now, this Lustig fella, a month later, he'd come back to Paris with the intention of selling the Eiffel Tower again. And this time, it didn't work out quite as well for him, because this time he got caught. he got caught, but somehow, rather, they say he somehow got away. But in 1934, this fellow was found guilty of counterfeiting. He pled guilty and was sentenced to 20 years in Alcatraz. In 1947, he died of pneumonia. A con man is a person who intentionally misleads another person, and usually for some kind of a financial gain, you know. Get some money out of them and don't give them anything in return. The Bible contains a number of stories that you can probably think about of con men that use all kinds of different trickeries and so forth. Maybe you're thinking of Samson and Delilah, you know, where Delilah got the secret of Samson's strength, cut off his hair and so forth. Maybe you remember or think about that story. Or maybe you think about Laban and how it relates to Jacob and him trying to marry one of Laban's daughters and how he got the wrong gal. That was kind of an underhanded deal, for sure. Then there's the ultimate con at the end time, when we read about the beast in the book of Revelation and other places that talk about the false prophet and the big con jobs. But let's take a look at 1 Peter chapter 5. Here Peter takes a very clear and concise statement in verse 8. So 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 8, way in the back here. Start out there. 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 8. Way in the back. 1 Peter chapter 5 and verse 8. And it says, "Be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary, the devil, walks about like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour." Seeking whom he may con, maybe we could say. Satan's playing a high-stakes con on mankind, and the stakes could not be higher. High-stakes con. Satan's not in it for the fun of it. He's not in it just to be playing a game. He's in it for the lasting demise of human beings. If it was up to him, he wants the whole program to fail. Of course, he's already been beat. He's already been defeated, but he keeps on trying, and, you know, he figures as long as he's got us to deal with and mankind and people in the world to deal with, maybe he's got a chance. I don't know. Maybe that's what he thinks. But he's not in it for the fun. He's in it for the demise of human beings. He wants nothing short of failure for all of mankind. He wants us to fail. He wants me to fail. You to fail. All your brothers and sisters around the world, he wants us all to fail and not reach our goal, not reach the end that the Father wants us to achieve. That's Satan's ultimate goal. He wants us to fail, and down the road, he wants eventually for all of mankind to fail. Of course, we know that's not going to happen. He wants to break apart that relationship that God wants for us and desires to have with us. Satan wants mankind not to be members of the family. He wants to break that relationship and cause it not to happen. How about 2 Corinthians chapter 11? 2 Corinthians chapter 11. See, I've always thought, you know, Dr. John was talking about memorizing. I always thought, wouldn't that be something maybe in the kingdom when we're listening to a sermon or a Bible study or something, and somebody gives a scripture, you don't have to turn to it because you know the whole book. You know exactly what it says. You don't have to turn to it. And that day probably is going to come. But 2 Corinthians chapter 11 and verse 3, it says, but I fear, 2 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 3, but I fear lest somehow as the serpent deceived Eve by his craftiness, so your minds may be corrupted from the simplicity that is in Christ. See, Paul was concerned about that church in Corinth. He didn't want that church there to become deceived. He didn't want them to become conned. He didn't want them to be conned by Satan. He didn't want them to end up drifting off and doing their own thing. And he brings Eve up. He mentions Eve. Satan didn't deceive Eve with openness and honesty. See, that's not how Satan operates. You know, Satan didn't say to Eve, okay, you know, and lay out the facts and lay out the truth. He twisted things. He didn't lay all the cards on the table. He didn't say, okay, Eve, that's exactly how it is. You know, God's telling you the truth. He's absolutely honest about everything. He's open and he's honest. You know, if you have a New King James, where Paul says, lest somehow I fear as a serpent deceived Eve by his craftiness. We just kind of read that. The serpent deceived Eve by his craftiness. The word craftiness here implies shrewdness. It implies cunning, some sort of cunning craft that Satan used. That's how Satan operates. He operates with slyness, cunning. Not out in the open. Not full of honesty. It's in the trees. It's in the bushes. It's in the wind. It's hidden. It's secret. It's being a con artist. You know, sometimes you hear people say, talking about somebody, and they'll say, well, he's a stranger from the truth. I mean, it sounds a little bit better than saying the guy's a bare-faced, outright bald-faced liar. Well, this guy's kind of a stranger from the truth. You know, not too friendly with the truth. Sometimes you hear people talking about somebody like that. But today we're going to explore Satan's tactics, because even now, today, he continues his master con job. The biggest con of all time. Which is the fact that man does not need God. That's ultimately what Satan is selling. That man doesn't need God. Man doesn't need his creator. Man doesn't need the master of all things, the creator of the whole universe, our Father. Mankind doesn't need that. That's the ultimate con that Satan is still trying to sell and has sold since the beginning of time. And you take a look around at our society today, and what do you see? You see what? Education throws God out. Government throws God out. Discredit religion and every possible chance Satan gets. you know, you just kind of look at the world around you and you can see that Satan's made some progress in this country, around the world even. Satan began that big con with mankind back in the third chapter of Genesis. He began it by talking to Eve back in the Garden of Eden. And if we go back to the story, the two trees back there in chapter 3, we read about the first sin that takes place here that is recorded for us. And if we go way back to Genesis chapter 3, first book in the Bible here, Genesis chapter 3 and verse 1. And let's see, let's go down through about verse 6. If you're there, follow along. If you're not, I'll read it to you. Genesis chapter 3 and verse 1. Now the serpent was more cunning than any beast of the field which the Lord God had made. And he said to the woman, "Has God indeed said, you shall not eat of every tree of the garden?" And the woman said to the serpent, "We may eat of the fruit of the trees of the garden, but of the tree, of the fruit of the tree which is in the midst of the garden, God has said, you shall not eat it, nor shall you touch it, lest you die." And the serpent said to the woman, "You shall not surely die." See, call God a liar right there. "For God knows that in the day that you eat of it, your eyes will be opened, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil." So when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, that it was pleasant to the eyes, and a tree desirable to make one wise, she took of its fruit and ate, and she also gave it to her husband with her, and he ate. See, that's part of the way Satan does things. That was a plan that he came up with, and he was going to try it out. So he sort of road tested it on Eve here. He gave it a test drove it, you might say. He test drove it with Eve, and it worked. It was successful. And he's been doing the same thing over and over again ever since. Look at verse 6, where it says that it was good for food. It says then it was pleasant to the eyes. And there was a desire there for knowledge that Satan was throwing out. These three are Satan's main tactics. All that trickery, his big con, involves one or more of these three things. Eve internalized that deception. She thought about it. She contemplated it. She compared it back with God's command. And we know that God's command was, if you go back to chapter 2 and verse 17, God was pretty clear about it. Genesis chapter 2, verse 17, nothing hard to understand here. It says, "But of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, you shall not eat. For in the day that you eat of it, you shall surely die." That's not too hard to figure out. Not pretty plain language. He said, "You do this, and this is what's going to happen." You don't have to stop and contemplate it, think about it, and wonder what it all meant. That's what God said. That's what God meant. That's what he said. It wasn't just something that God said, "Okay, there's this tree, don't eat it." And maybe Eve was daydreaming. See, maybe you could give her the benefit of the doubt. Or maybe Eve didn't really pay much attention. Maybe she wasn't paying a whole lot of attention to it. Maybe it just went in one ear and out the other. Well, we know that's not the case because she told the serpent exactly what the command was. She parroted it back. God said, "Don't eat of that tree." So it wasn't that Eve just allowed God's words to kind of go in one ear and out the other. And she didn't internalize it. She knew what the command was. She heard it. She understood it. And if there is no question in her mind, because she was able to tell the serpent back what that command was. We know that she heard it. And it's very easy to understand. It's not some complex, abstract thought that's, you know, you get a whole room full of philosophers to talk about it and try to figure out what it meant. It's plain, just plain English. Just said it clear. Eve here is taken in by that big con man, Satan the devil. But you see, Adam wasn't. Adam was a little bit different. They both sinned, but Scripture tells us that Adam wasn't deceived. Here's something kind of interesting. It says Eve was deceived. Adam wasn't deceived. How is it possible that Eve was deceived and sinned, and Adam wasn't deceived in the same way that she was, but he sinned too? Kind of interesting. I don't know if you thought about why is that. If you think about that for a couple minutes, well, hopefully we'll answer that as we go along here. But Eve was deceived. Adam wasn't. They both sinned. What happened? What in the world happened? Well, let's go to Galatians. How about Galatians chapter 6 and verse 7? Galatians. Over in the New Testament here. Galatians and chapter 6. And verse 7. Do not be deceived. God is not mocked. For whatever a man sows, that will he also reap. The word deceived, as it comes out of the Greek, means to roam from the truth or to simply go astray, is basically the interpretation of that word. To roam from the truth or to go astray. One could be deceived is to literally, one way to be deceived is to literally move away from the truth. It's voluntary action. It's voluntary. You consciously do it. We can be here today. We can go home. We can choose to do anything we want to. We can choose to remain firm, steadfast in church and the truth and the scriptures, or we can choose not to. That would be this Greek word that is translated from us in our English Bibles as the word deceived. To voluntarily move away, to voluntarily go astray. We have the choice. And over the years, you know, those of us that have been around for a while, oh boy, then the list of names that we could come up of all those that we've known over the years, over the decades even, that have gone astray, that have drifted off, that have been conned. The people that, not even a year after 1995, that were keeping Christmas and doing all those other things. We have that choice. We have that choice every day. We can go home. We can wake up tomorrow morning. We can say, no thanks, I don't want to go to church. I don't want to crack open this book. I don't want to spend any time praying or anything like that or meditating. I don't, you know, I want to go back to eating all those things that I used to eat and learn better. Because people did. Oh, boy, did people ever go back. Eating all those things and doing all those things, and it didn't take them long. It didn't take them long to forget. But it's a choice. It is a choice. There's people who say, well, I want this and I want that. And I want to go to the top, but I'll do anything I can to get there. I don't care who I step on. I don't care who I hurt. I just want to get there, no matter what. Those are the things I want. And we can voluntarily move away from the truth of God. Voluntarily move away. Regardless of the reason, Satan has these tactics. And he presents us with a choice. So do we grab hold of that and allow ourselves to be deceived and allow ourselves to voluntarily move away from the truth, to voluntarily move away from God? It's a sobering thought. But it's one that I think it's good for us to think about and ask ourselves. Most of the words in the Bible that are translated deceived are this Greek word that again simply means to move away from the truth, a voluntary action to move away. So is this what Eve did? Is this what Eve did? Did she just voluntarily move away? Is that what she did? You know, if we go back and look at Genesis chapter 3, is that what she did? Well, did she just voluntarily move away from the truth? Well, actually, she didn't. That's not what she did. If we go back over to 1 Timothy, let's take a look at Adam here for a little bit. 1 Timothy chapter 2. Paul tells us a little bit about Adam and Eve and the deception that they fell into, the sin that resulted. You know, 1 Timothy chapter 2, verse 13. 1 Timothy 2, 13. For Adam was formed first, then Eve, in verse 14 says, first, and Adam was not deceived. But the woman, being deceived, fell into transgression. So there's a clear scripture that kind of tells us Adam was not deceived. Eve was. The Greek word here for deceived means to cheat or to beguile. It means to trick someone into doing something. That's the Greek word here that Paul uses. So Adam was not tricked into sinning. He did it voluntarily. He did it voluntarily. They both ended up sinning. There's no doubt about that. But God's instruction was clear. Don't eat this. And they both ate away. They both broke God's commandments. One translation renders 1 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 14 and says that Adam was not tricked. Another translation says Adam was not fooled. The Revised says that Adam was not tricked into doing something. He wasn't tricked. He wasn't deceived. Satan has three tactics in that big con that he tries to push off on us. He can trick you to sin, or he can trick someone else close to you to sin, knowing that you will follow. Now, how many times do you suppose you've seen that over the years where, let's just say, a husband, for whatever reason, decides to leave the church? And how many times did the wife just follow along? That happened all the time. That happened many, many, many times. One left and the other followed. Just like Adam and Eve. One was tricked and fooled, and the other one wasn't. He followed. And that's exactly what he did with Adam and Eve. He tricked Eve into sinning and hoping that Adam would follow, and that's exactly what happened. And they both ended up sinning. Either way, the sin that results creates a wall or creates a separatism or a separation between the persons, that individual, and their God. So we're going to look maybe a little bit more at those tactics that Satan throws at us. Let's go to 1 John, way in the back here. 1 John in chapter 2. 1 John chapter 2. And verse 15, at least we'll start in verse 15. 1 John chapter 2, verse 15. And it says, do not love the world or the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life. Those three things. Lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life is not of the Father, but is of the world. And the world is passing away in the just in the lust of it. But he who does the will of God abides forever. Little children, it is the last hour. And as you have heard that the Antichrist is coming, even now, many Antichrists have come by which we know that it is the last hour. But he who changes, he who transforms. See, that's the ultimate goal of all of us. We want to change from what we were to what we need to become. We all want to change to becoming more like God. We all want that. We each want to be transformed. We want to be in the process of being transformed. We take that commitment at baptism. You know, what do we always talk about? We say, well, you bury the old man. You bury the old woman. And we come up somebody new. Somebody that's going to change, big change. And it's a daily struggle to keep that old person buried. It doesn't mean we're successful all the time, because many times we're not. You know, anybody that's been baptized and says, well, I've never committed a single sin since I've been baptized, is a stranger from the truth. Because we all have. We all have. So it's a daily struggle to keep that person buried, to keep that person down as we continue to resist ourself. We grow in godly character. We begin to have the mindset that God wants us to have. And those tactics, though, those tactics of Satan are given to us here in verse 16. In verse 16. These are the tactics that Satan uses so that we don't grow, so that we don't try to transform, so we don't desire to change, to become more godly. So let's take a little bit deeper here. Let's look a little bit deeper here in verse 16 of 1 John chapter 2. I'll read it again. 1 John chapter 2, verse 16. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life is not of the Father, but is of the world. These are the three tactics that Satan likes to use, that Satan does use. These are the three that he used with Adam and Eve. And these are the same three that he used with Jesus Christ when he tempted Jesus Christ. And these are the same three that he continues to use on you and me right down through time, right down to the present time, right down to the present age. So the first item that's mentioned here is the lust of the flesh. Lust of the flesh. These are temptations that reside in the flesh. The key concept that you can think of here regarding the lust of the flesh is that it is for physical gratification. Physical gratification is that lust of the flesh is usually involves in fairly large subject here, but sometimes physical possessions. You know, how important is it to have the latest and the greatest and the biggest and the best? Some people, it's so important that it pushes out everything else. See, that's kind of the bottom line. That's kind of how you determine if it's becoming wrong in your life. See, having stuff isn't wrong. You know, there's lots of people in the Bible that were wealthy. You know, Abraham King David. I mean, there's lots of people in the, you know, having stuff isn't wrong, but it can be a tool of Satan. It can be used to tempt us. And sometimes they do. And sometimes we do. So we have to ask ourselves, what's in our lives that give us pleasure? It doesn't necessarily have to be anything wrong. If it's something that you yearn for, or something that you wear, or something that you drive, or whatever it is, or to make some other physical possession, then it is an area where Satan's trying to get you. See, there's the thing. If that's an area of your life where you have a kind of a weakness, and some people do, some people don't. But if that's an area of your life where you have a kind of a weakness, you don't think Satan's going to hone in on that? Boy, he will. He'll hone in that big time. Physical gratification. You know, and we can also talk about addictions. You know, people that are addicted to alcohol, people that are addicted to drugs like meth and like heroin and things like that. You know, they'll crawl over with their bare knees over busted glass to get a fix of meth or heroin or something like that. I mean, it's hard for us maybe to imagine that kind of addiction, but it destroys people's lives. You know, so I know there used to be a kind of a. I don't know if you call it a controversy, but some people would want to argue, well, there's nothing really wrong with smoking. But you know what? Smoking is a terribly addictive thing. Terribly, terribly, terribly addictive thing. Anybody that's been hooked on it and had to quit knows how hard that was, how hard it is. And so that's just something that Satan can use that. If there's a weakness you have there, Satan can hone in on that. Second item that he talks here is the lust of the eyes. That's where you're satisfied with contemplating the tactics seeks mental gratification. So lust of the flesh is the physical gratification. Lust of the eyes is mental gratification. It's all up in our mind. It evolves The use of imagination involves the use of imagination. It's things you dream about. It's things you spend your time thinking about. It's the crazy, over-the-top dreams that we maybe have sometimes. You know, we think about all, you know, all the good things that could happen to us, you know, having a job that pays lots and lots of money, or maybe opening up your door and there's the, what do you call that, the prize patrol? Is that what it is, the prize patrol? Standing there with that great big check, you know, and they got the roses and the cameras and stuff for there. And there it is, you know, $5 million right up front, $7,000 a week for the rest of your life. Now, wouldn't that be cool? Wouldn't that be nice? Wouldn't that be nice? Or the publisher's clearinghouse. I get those things once in a while, but if there's a little piece of paper in there that tells you what your odds are of winning, did you ever look at that? You know what it is? 1 in 1,750,000,000. So it's almost a sure bet, you know? As soon as you send that thing in, you might as well go out and get yourself a new Rolls Royce because the check's about to, probably going to come. But it's a sure thing, but it's a sure thing that you won't get it. Somebody told me one time that your chances of winning the lottery were about the same if you bought a ticket or didn't buy a ticket. It doesn't really make much difference. Your chances are still about zero of winning. But, boy, some people, they spend all their time and they think about that, dream about that. That's why coveting is so wrong, and because people can end up dwelling on it. You know, is it wrong? You know, have you committed a big sin? If you think, oh, I wonder what that'd be like if the old prize patrol showed up. Nah, that's not a sin. But if it becomes so important in your life that you're not doing the things you're supposed to do because you're daydreaming about something like that, then it actually becomes sin for us. We end up thinking about that, and that ends up consuming our time. There's little physical action, but there's lots of mental thoughts, and there's lots of human reasoning and human logic as far as why that would be so good for me. And yet, we've probably all seen maybe the programs where they followed some of these people that's won these huge multi-million-dollar prizes. And this one guy, he won $300 million, I think it was, but a few years later, his life was in such shambles that he said, I wished that I tore it up and threw it away. That's what he actually said. So maybe it's not as good for us as we might think. And we put ourselves in situations and we end up running that situation through and through and through our minds again and again. The lust of the eyes is that mental gratification. It's the imagination. It's the things you dream about. And the part of it that becomes wrong is when it begins to push God out. Anything, whether it's physical, mental, whatever, when you begin to push God out and not give him the proper time that he wants and needs. And the third thing here is mentioned by John in 1 John chapter 2 is the pride of life. It's a vain assurance in our own ability, our own stability, our own resources. It's a vain assurance in our own resources or our own stability involves things like power and control and prestige. The view is that people look to you as something great. Did you ever know anybody that wanted everybody to, you know, just notice them and just be in awe when they walk by? I've known people like that. You can just kind of tell somebody like that when they want to be thought of as so extremely important and so. Now, everybody mostly is an expert at something. You know, if you're sick, you go to a doctor. You know, if your teeth hurt, you go to a dentist. Or if your car don't work right, you find somebody that knows how to fix it. Or if your roof leaks, you find somebody that can fix your roof. So people have expertise. And so, you know, somebody comes to you and you're an expert in whatever field it is and ask your advice. Well, they're only doing it because they need your advice and you're an expert at it. They're not inferring that you're something so ultra extra special that they should kind of sit around and just admire you for a little while before they start talking to you. There's some people, you almost get the idea that that's how they view themselves. And that's wrong. That's what it's talking about here. That's wrong. It becomes about ego. That's the pride of life. It's that self-pride. It's that greatness of me. It's that pride life. The pride of life results in the lack of trust with God because you end up not needing God, thinking you don't need God. These three things, lust of the flesh, lust of the eyes, the pride of life, they all come in a variety of forms. If we break down any of those temptations and if we break down any of these challenges, we can drive all of them back to one of these three things as a rule. Satan's tactics. These three Satan's tactics. They just come in different size boxes, different colored wrapping, different kind of ribbons, different presentations. But at the root of these are the three things that Satan throws at mankind. He did it with Eve. He's done it down through the pages of history. So let's kind of go back here for just a little bit to Genesis chapter 3 again. Let's go back to the story of Adam and Eve back in the garden. And what were the three things that Eve said that this fruit was good for? She said it was good for food. That's the physical gratification. It's something tangible. It's something physical. And she was looking for something physical to satisfy her. That's the lust of the flesh that Satan threw at her. She also said that it was pleasant to the eyes. The eyes can't touch something physical, but the eyes are kind of the windows to our mind, sometimes we say, and allows us to think about things and ponder things and imagine things. And she was able to look at that fruit then and have that feel-good emotion about eating the fruit. That's the lust of the eyes. And the third thing that she mentioned was that the fruit was desirable for knowledge. That is the pride of life, the desire to know and to think you know as much as God does. Or maybe in some cases you think, oh, I even know more than God knows. Satan doesn't change. He continues to be sly. He continues to be subtle. And he alters how these three tactics are packaged. But when we analyze them, that's what he throws at us. If we look at Matthew chapter 4, we can go back to the time that Satan was able to tempt Christ. This is an interesting thought here. And how did Satan use these tactics when he tempted Christ when he was out in the wilderness? Again, packaged maybe a little bit different. But at the root of the same three things were thrown at Christ. Look at Matthew chapter 4, verse 1. Matthew chapter 4 and verse 1. Matthew chapter 4, verse 1 and verse 2. And Jesus was led up by the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. And when he had fasted 40 days and 40 nights, afterward he was hungry. Now, it should go without saying that he's hungry. 40 days and 40 nights for most of us, or maybe all of us, 40 days and 40 nights, we'd be dead. Wouldn't even be alive, maybe, after 40 days and 40 nights of fasting. But it says here that he was hungry. Matthew records a fact here that he was obviously hungry. Verse 3, Now when the tempter came to him, he said, If you are the Son of God, command that these stones become bread. You see what he was throwing at Christ here? He was seeking physical gratification. You know, you're hungry. You've been fasting 40 days and 40 nights, and your stomach has got to be pretty empty by that time. You need something to put into your stomach, and you're hungry for sure. You need food. You know you do. But here, if you're the Son of God, snap your fingers and make bread appear. Lust of the flesh. It's that physical gratification. And here, Satan is coming at Christ with a temptation to satisfy himself physically. Make yourself some bread, Satan said. Snap your fingers, you know. Let that manna rain down from heaven. Because Satan knew all about manna. He remembered back in the Israelites, back in the desert and how the manna appeared every morning. He remembered that. Here's Satan tempting Christ, and here, snap your fingers, bring some manna down so that you've got something to eat. Trying to get Christ to obey him. Chapter 4, verse 5, then the devil took him up into the holy city, set him on the pinnacle of the temple. And verse 6, and he said to him, if you are the Son of God, throw yourself down, for it is written, he shall give his angels charge concerning you, and in their hands they shall bear you up, lest you dash your foot against a stone. See, here Satan's tempting Jesus with being above God's authority. Kind of analyze what he did here. He's tempting Jesus with trying to control what God would do. He's trying to force the control of a situation of God the Father by dictating perhaps that what God would do or wasn't planning on doing. But he said, you know, here, do this, you know, jump off this thing here and the angels will have to come and catch you. The angels will have to come and do that. Force God's hand. Force God's hand. Make God react by something that you did. He's trying to force the control of a situation of God the Father, dictating perhaps even what God would do. Throw yourself down, and your Father will have to save you. You be the one that's in charge. You call the shots. You control what your Father does. You be the one to dictate what he does. This is the pride of life. You can control what happens. That's what Satan was throwing at him. Verse 8. Again, the devil took him up on an exceedingly high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms of the world and their glory. And verse 9 says, and he said to him, all these things I will give you if you will fall down and worship me. Now he moves into his mind. He begins to play those mental games with Jesus Christ. The lust of the eyes. Think about how great you would be. Let me show you all these mountains. Let me show you all these kingdoms. Let me show you all these cities. You know, did he show him the skyline of New York and London and Paris? Did he do that? Don't know. But he was showing something that was pretty impressive. And you begin to sit there and think for a minute how great it would be or how awesome it would be if you were in charge of all this. And I've always thought, that's kind of interesting, you know, Satan pulling that on Christ, because here we are in this little speck of dust out in the outer arms of the Milky Way galaxy, and Jesus Christ knows what's out there because he created it. And here's Satan saying, here, I'll give you a couple of these little cities on this little speck of dust if you fall down and worship. It doesn't make much sense, but that's what Satan was trying to do. That's what he was trying to do. Satan tries to get Jesus Christ to lock into his imagination and start dreaming about all that power. I mean, I can see why that didn't work too well. But it's a tactic that Satan still used. And you know what? 4,000 years later, and the tactics haven't changed up to this point. It's the same basic process that Satan still uses. You try one, and if it doesn't work, you try the next one. And if that one doesn't work, then you go on and you try another one. And you keep hitting. And you keep putting different bows on the package. And you keep wrapping it in different colored paper. But Satan wants you to eventually fall for one of them. He's very smart. He's very tricky. Let's go to Matthew chapter 13. A couple pages forward here. Jesus Christ ends up talking about these tactics to give us a little more insight. Matthew chapter 13 and verse 3. And we'll read a few verses here. Verse 3. Matthew chapter 13 and verse 3. And he spoke many things to them in parables, saying, behold, a sower went out to sow, and as he sowed, some seed fell by the wayside, and the birds came and devoured it. And some fell on stony places where they did not have much earth, and they immediately sprang up because they had no depth of earth. But when the sun was up, they were scorched, and because they had no root, They withered away. And some fell among thorns, and the thorns sprang up and choked them. But others fell on good ground and yielded a crop, some 100, some 60, some 30. He who has an ear, let him hear. Have you ever wondered why not all the seed takes place? Seems, you know, here's the sower. Why doesn't, when he throws out the seeds, why isn't all the ground fertile? Why doesn't every single seed spring up? Why does this parable even apply? Why is it that God just doesn't throw out the seed and all of it lands on fertile ground and all of it produces a fabulous crop? Why doesn't that happen? Why doesn't that happen? Why is the parable not that way? Why isn't the church, with all the years of putting out all the magazines and all the booklets and all the TV and all the radio over the decades, why isn't the church millions and millions and millions of people? Why isn't it that every town that any of us live in, why isn't there just one, you know, great big church building in the middle of the town, and that's, you know, everybody's going to the Church of God? Why isn't it that way? Why isn't there millions of people in the church? Why isn't morality in this country or any country, why isn't that higher? Why isn't marriage more sacred? Why is it almost a sure thing that the United States Supreme Court in just a few weeks is going to make same-sex marriage the law of the land? Because that's almost for sure coming very soon. Why are families not strong and safe and secure? Well, Satan wants it all to fail. That's the con that Satan's running. He wants society to think that they have no need for God. There's no need for God. That's the message that Satan is selling. You can do it on your own. And probably do it better. You can make your own decisions. You can decide what's marriage and what's not marriage. You can decide what's right and what's wrong, what's good and what's bad. You're successful. You can do it. Lean on your own understanding. You have what it takes. If you think hard enough, you'll be successful. That's the bill of goods that Satan is selling this world right now. We're right in the middle of it. Well, let's look at what Christ had something to say about that parable. Matthew chapter 13 and verse 18. And verse 19, verse 18. Therefore, hear the parable of the sower. When anyone hears the word of the kingdom and does not understand it, then the wicked one comes and snatches away that which was sown in his heart. This is he who received seed by the wayside. That's the lesson of the eyes. That's the emotion. That's the mental games. Verse 20. But he who receives the seed on stony places, this is the one who hears the word and immediately receives it with joy. Verse 21. Yet he has no root in himself, but endures only for a while, for then tribulation or persecution arises because of the word, and immediately he stumbles. The stony person is the one who falls prey to the lusts of the flesh. Physical gratification. Tribulation hurts. It causes pain. I don't like it. I'm not comfortable with that. It's not pleasant. I want to make myself safe. I want to be protected. Our human self-protection kicks in, and you do what you have to in order to protect yourself, to protect your body, protect yourself. But there's seed that falls prey to the lusts of the flesh. It's that physical gratification that it seeks. It becomes more important to be comfortable than to please God. That's the bottom line. Verse 22. Now, he who received seed among the thorns is he who hears the word, and the cares of this world and the deceitfulness of riches choke the word, and he becomes unfruitful. The thorny person is the one who falls prey to the pride of life. That's the riches. That's the fame. That's the power. That's control, the prestige. Remember, the pride of life is the one individual who has this vain assurance in their own resources. Over in James, James continues that concept by talking about Satan's tactics. You know, we could go over to James chapter 3, and we'll go there and see what he has to say about it. James chapter 3 and verse 15 is where we're going to go. He talks more about these three tactics, these three ideas, these three goals of Satan. Again, he just wants us to fail in any one of these. Any one of them will do. He doesn't want us to hit. He doesn't have to hit us with all three. He can trip us up with the physical gratification, or he can trip us up by getting us to imagine the plan and these, you know, think about these daydreams. Or he can get us locked in on being comfortable in our own self-vain assurance of our own resources that he's able to be successful. He just wants to get tripped up. Just one of these. James chapter 3, verse 15. James chapter 3, verse 15. This wisdom does not descend from above, but it's earthly, it says. It has the lust of the flesh. It's physically oriented. It measures success in worldly terms. Its aims and goals are worldly. It's unable to go beyond the limits of this world to gain perspective on things that are godly. Again, this is the physical component, the physical gratification. And James goes on to say this wisdom does not descend from above, but it's earthly, and it is sensual. These are the areas that are the mind game. It's the lust of the eyes. It's mental. Jude verse 19, don't necessarily have to turn there, but it says, these are sensual persons who cause division, not having the Spirit. We are familiar with the 28th chapter of Ezekiel, where it talks about how Satan became so prideful. And actually, what it says in Ezekiel 28, verse 17, says, your heart was lifted up because of your beauty. You have corrupted your wisdom. This is the pride of life. You know, the, oh, look at me. Oh, look at how wonderful I am. I have all this assurance of who I am and the resources that I have at my disposal. And you know what? Satan kind of got hooked up on one of his own tactics. And it helped to bring him down. And those tactics lead to sin. In James chapter 1, verse 10, James chapter 1 and verse 14, it says, but each one is tempted when he is drawn away by his own desires and enticed. And verse 15, then when desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin. And sin, when it is full grown, brings forth death. Do not be deceived, my brethren, my beloved brethren. So James tells us that it begins with desires and enticements. And you know, there's a, I don't know, you could probably give a half a dozen sermons on where does sin come from. You know, I've heard them. I think I've given some. Where does sin come from? But you know, sometimes it's our own actions that bring forth sin. You know, we think about a proposal. We think about something that's proposed to us or presented to us. And then we have a choice. We have a choice to think about what's been proposed or presented to us, and then we make a decision. What am I going to do with that? You know, maybe it there's so many things, but maybe it's a party you're invited to. And you have to make a decision. Should I or shouldn't I? And you maybe know the people, you know maybe what goes on there. You have to make a decision. Should I or shouldn't I? That's part of character, knowing what's right or wrong, choosing the right. Maybe it's some gossip that you heard that you shouldn't pass on. You have to make a decision. Maybe it's a little white lie that you wouldn't necessarily have to tell. Maybe it's a movie that we shouldn't see. Maybe it's some music that we shouldn't listen to. And we have a neighbor kid. I think he's a high school kid. He's just graduating now this spring. He's got a car, and he, when the weather's warm, the windows are down. It's one of them things, you know, they turn the radio way, way, way up, and the you can hear the thing coming for a mile, but some of the lyrics, some of the words are unbelievable. I can't, you know, when I was a kid, there's no way, no way that there'd be words like that in a song. And you hear these kids that are listening to it, it doesn't seem to bother them at all. Maybe it's some activity on the Sabbath that we're invited to, and we think, should I or shouldn't I? Is it right or is it wrong? We have to make the decision. Maybe it's a disclosure that you didn't make. Yeah, I knew the car only got 50 miles to a quart of oil, but he never asked me how much oil it took. So it's okay. So it's okay. He didn't ask. That could be a sin. Maybe it's the way we talked to our wife. Maybe it's the way we talked to our kids. Maybe it's a little cheating that we did on a test, or maybe it's a maybe it's a box of paper clips that we took home from work that amounts to a couple cents, and yet it wasn't really ours to take. All these little things, all these little decisions, all these things that we have to look at and decide, how are we going to do? How are we going to react to that? What am I going to do? How am I going to handle that? Matthew chapter 26, verse 41 says, the spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. And how true is that? We want to follow that way of life that we're on, that we've started on. We want to resist Satan. We want not to sin one more time until the day we die. All of us want that. Not a single one of us want to walk out of this room and sin. Nobody does. And yet, the truth of the matter is, all of us are going to, in some way or another. Satan knows that we're weak, and he knows that these three tactics keep us hoping that one of them will grab us, one of them will take hold of us. This is their recourse, the Spirit. We have a Spirit that is willing. Those who are baptized and have God's Spirit working in us have a desire not to sin. We desire to be more like God. We desire to have this enthusiasm for God's way of life. But we know that it says in Romans chapter 13, verse 14, that the Spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. To put on the Lord Jesus Christ and make no provision for the flesh in order to fulfill its lusts. Well, those are the tactics that Satan uses. We are to make no provisions. We're to be aware of those tactics. We're to be aware of how Satan tries to trip us up. We're to be aware of how and where and when and how he wants us to fail. Because that's what he wants us to do, is to fail, absolutely fail. We should not be making provisions for the flesh. We should be mindful of who we are. We should be mindful of our thoughts. We should be mindful of the things that are pleasing to our eyes. I don't know if anybody's ever heard the name George Parker. But he was one of the most brazen con men in American history. He made his living selling New York public landmarks to tourists. Beware if you go to New York. But his favorite object for sales was the Brooklyn Bridge. He ended up selling the Brooklyn Bridge up to twice a week for a long time, many years actually. He convinced those people he conned that they could make a fortune by controlling access to the Brooklyn Bridge. More than once, the police had to remove naive buyers from the bridge, as those buyers ended up trying to erect toll barriers for entrance to the bridge. Other public landmarks he sold were the original Madison Square Garden. He sold the Metropolitan Museum of Art. He sold Grant's tomb. He sold the Statue of Liberty. Pretty good salesman. George had many different methods for making the sales. When he sold Grant's tomb, he would often pose as the general's grandson. He would even set up a fake office in order to handle the real estate transactions, or maybe we should say swindles. He produced many impressive forged documents in order to prove that he was the legal owner of whatever property he was attempting to sell. George Parker was convicted of fraud three different times. After his third conviction in December of 1928, he was sentenced to a life term in Sing Sing prison. And he spent the last 8 years of his life behind bars. George Parker was very popular among the guards and other fellow inmates because he would often tell stories about his exploits. George is remembered as one of the most successful cons in the history of the United States, as well as one of history's most talented hoaxers. His exploits have passed into popular culture, giving rise to popular phrases such as, if you believe that, I have a bridge to sell you. You hear that all the time. If you believe that, I've got a bridge to sell you. That's where that came from. Good old George Parker did that. A popular way of expressing a belief that someone is maybe a little bit on the gullible side. But gullible, that's what Satan wants. Satan wants us to be gullible because if we aren't gullible, it's easier to swallow his con. Eve is who Satan wants us to be, but if we can't be an Eve, then he wants us to be an Adam. And he wants someone close to us to be the gullible one and then for us to follow that person, just like Adam followed Eve. Satan wants someone who is easy to be conned, someone who seeks physical gratification, someone who is happy contemplating and imagining, someone who has the assurance and seeks the safety of their own resources. Let's look at Galatians 5:16, probably as we end here. Galatians 5:16. Galatians chapter 5, 16 says, I say then, walk in the Spirit, and you shall not fulfill the lusts of the flesh. If we are continuously focused on God, if we have our eyes on the kingdom, if we have our eyes set on overcoming and trying to rid off the ways of Satan, this way of life that's contrary to God's way, then we're not going to end up fulfilling the lusts of the flesh. Verse 17 says, For the flesh lusts against the spirit, and the spirit against the flesh. And these are contrary to one another, so that you do not do the things that you wish. If you don't let the Spirit of God lead you, and then if you sort of end up living out your physical life according to the fleshly desires of this life, like almost all the whole world does, we would end up falling prey to the lusts of the eyes, the lusts of the flesh, and the pride of life. We all struggle, though. We all have moments. We all have to wrestle, and we all sin. We all wrestle with controlling our flesh on a daily basis, maybe on an hourly basis, maybe every second of every minute. We need to strive to live God's way of life and striving to live more godly. So let's be aware of how Satan tempts us to sin. Know how you can be torn away due to physical gratification or the imagination of your mind. It can so easily overrun us. God offers the help needed to stay on the course and to avoid Satan's tactics. So let's always be on our knees and keeping our eyes in the Bible. Now we'll be observing Pentecost in a week or so. Let's be thanking God for the gift that makes it possible for us to resist Satan's attacks. Let's be sure we put that gift to use.